Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirits Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Brian Diaz here with you. Welcome to the unofficial start of the weekend here in the Crescent City, friends. Yes, at NOLA Drinks. We don't need a note card to remind us, I hear you. Here at NOLA Drinks, friends, we hear you. We hear you. Hey, we got a good show coming up for you here today. Our featured interview, which is really the vast majority of the show, is with my good friend Pepper Bowen, who is the director of the Culinaria Program. She was on with us not too long ago, about a month ago. The Culinaria Program is under the large umbrella of the National Food and Beverage Foundation. The main thing that they operate here in New Orleans, of course, is the Southern Food and Beverage Museum there in Central City. But the Culinaria Program is a program, a food policy program specifically, that encapsulates legal stuff, cultural stuff, education, lots of different things. And Pepper is just a wealth of knowledge of things. And in celebration of Black History Month, we talk about various things with Pepper in a very extensive interview. As she always jokes, whenever she and I get together and have conversations, it's never a linear conversation. That's probably fair. Probably conversation better served for over cocktails, as we do from time to time. But getting all that to work in a structure of a radio show may be a little more difficult. Hopefully we captured a lot of that stuff. What we talk about various things. It's a pretty wide-ranging conversation. But we talk about the role New Orleans played in the civil rights movement, and very specifically as Culinaria is a food program. We talk about the kitchens and when people that were here, when I say kitchens, you know, places where when people would come, often come to New Orleans as a base of operation and then move throughout the region, the Freedom Riders, to go pursue activism, register people to vote, these different things. People obviously had to sleep, they had to eat, and New Orleans was a center for that, a center for people to come and organize, maybe regroup perhaps. And again, you had to eat. One of the most famous places that people know is Dookie Chase, played a strong role in that. And, you know, I think as we point out in the interview, for example, it's harder to find out more about other places because this was meant to be clandestine. These people were trying to keep things under wraps so that they were not rooted out. And that obviously makes a lot of sense. But we talk a little bit about that. We talk, we even get into some topics that Pepper's been doing some research on about African-American women selling pralines in Congo Square back in the colonial era, post-colonial era, you know, as well as leading up to the Civil War. And we touch on all kinds of other things as well as it relates to food, but with a particular focus in this case, I think, on African-American culture and all the way really with a big focus, again, on civil rights and some other things. It's a very interesting conversation. And again, it is kind of all over the place, but I think you'll find it fascinating. So that's what we got going on today. Some sad news that I want to announce happened late last week after we ran the show then. Arthur J. Robinson, of course, better known as Mr. Okra, passed away from a heart attack at age 75. He was an icon here in New Orleans. He was 74. If you're from here or you've been here, you know the look of that truck, the way it was painted. He was a man who delivered fresh produce to neighborhoods, kind of a really was a dying breed of people that, you know, you delivered. And like in many parts of the country, certainly the idea of a delivery man kind of seems to be going away, at least not in the modern, in the modern conception that we have now, maybe where you're getting stuff delivered by Amazon. It's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, you know, the waffle man, the ice cream man, the milk man. And Mr. Okra was a guy who delivered produce. And he did this for over 50 years, sadly, again, passed away late last week. And you would know, again, as I said, that painted truck, that the sound of the tinny speakers when he would tell people what he had. I have oranges, I have bananas. His song, if you will, I'll call it a song because that's really what it was, has been used and sampled by different musicians, including the Dave Matthews Band. Great song by Bonorama out there called Mr. Okra. There's a great song out there by the Seven Walkers called For the Love of Mr. Okra. And a sad thing, really. The good news is that his daughter, Sergio Robinson, will be continuing the operation and running the truck, delivering fresh produce to neighborhoods. And that's really, really good news. A couple stories. One of the things that I was reading after he passed that I thought was very cool. You know, he left during Katrina, as many people did. And a few months later, he came back. And one of the things that he saw not too long after he came back was a refrigerator left along the road. And it said, quote, please find Mr. Okra. We need him. And in keeping with that, when he made his first round in the recovering city after Katrina, he gave away produce for free. If you know who he is, you know what I'm talking about. If you don't, go read about it. He's a true icon. The funeral, if you're interested, will be taking place this Sunday, the 25th at 3 p.m. And there's a walkthrough funeral at the Marigny Opera House. And then there's going to be a second line that goes on from the Marigny Opera House to BJ's Lounge, which is at 4301 Burgundy Street. And the Preservation Hall is going to be leading up or taking charge of the music, I should say, in the second line. And that's going to be led by the terrific Kinfolk Brass Band. And my buddy Daryl Dancing Man Young is also going to be leading the second line. So the route starts on Dauphine at that side of the street by the Marigny Opera House, and then turns left onto Lesseps and ends again at BJ's Lounge, 4301 Burgundy Street, 3 o'clock on Sunday, if you want to check that out. Again, good news that it's going to carry on, though. Good Mr. Okra, the legacy lives on. Friends, something I touched on a couple weeks ago, I think probably even leading up to Mardi Gras, I can't quite remember. It's still that fog, that haze that was Mardi Gras, as always. Recycling your beads. And I did share something on this on Facebook the other day, but wanted to mention this, that the great organization, Ark of Greater New Orleans, a wonderful charity, nonprofit here in the city, they did a great thing. They went around, they did a pilot program where they followed crew of Ferret and crew of Toth with handing out recycle bags. They had a truck that followed the parade where you could hand them your bags full of throws, and they had some stations along the Uptown Parade route where you could go drop your beads off. But what they're doing to continue that program is most of the New Orleans libraries in the parish there in Orleans Parish, you can drop your beads off to be recycled, and the Ark of Greater New Orleans turns those around. I think they're able to sell them for something like $1 a pound, and that helps fund a lot of their programs. So that's a great way to do it. Just go drop them off. You can easily find it if you go to the Ark of New Orleans website, which libraries, there seem to be about 10 or so that are taking those on, and just go drop them off. Please, friends, don't throw them away. Please recycle them. They're pretty cheap plastic. They got a lot of bad stuff going on in them. So let's recycle them. That's a good way to do it. And also a quick note too, that I'm seeing in the comments here on an article talking about where you can drop those off. They're looking for volunteers for March 10th from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. to help sort the beads. And I think what they do is they kind of sort them by size and these different things, and as a way to then turn around and recycle them properly as they need to be disposed of. So go check out the Ark of New Orleans website if you're looking to get rid of your beads. A little bit of news I'll mention. A great honor here at the NOLA Drink Show. I'm really excited about this. I was just talking about the National Food and Beverage Foundation. It's a wonderful organization. As I said, they operate the Southern Food and Beverage Museum here. They also operate a museum similarly in Los Angeles. It's the museum here is also the Museum of the American Cocktail. They've got an absinthe exhibit. Lots of education programs, lots of resources, lots of support for folks, entrepreneurs looking to get into the culinary world. Their test kitchen is terrific. A really great organization. I've been involved with them lately in different ways, aside from interviewing folks connected to the organization like Pepper today. But they are launching a podcast network, and it's the National Food and Beverage Podcast Network, and they have asked this show, I'm humbled and honored to be a part of this, to be one of the first half a dozen or so podcasts that are going to be part of this platform. So it will be distributed as it always is. You know, we have the radio show, as you know, and you can get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn Radio, of course, at noladrinks.com. But another way that you're going to be able to connect with the show is through the National Food and Beverage Foundation, and be on the lookout for that. That's going to be launching very, very, very soon, and you'll be able to find the NOLA Drink Show there as well. Looking forward to working with those folks. Should be a lot of fun. A little bit later on in the show, friends, after we get to our interview with Pepper here in just a few minutes, we'll close out the show. We're going to talk a little bit about the recent announcement of the James Beard semifinalist. Decent representation again here in New Orleans, as there should be. 14 nominees, at least through the semifinals at this point. A little bit of news coming out, Tales of the Cocktail, a little bit about next week's show. Probably talk a little bit about French Quarter Festival. They just announced their lineup as well. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the show. Be back with our featured interview with Pepper Bowen of Culinaria. Come on back.
Oregon wines are taking over New Orleans. The reason? They're delicious. Next time you're shopping for wine, grab a bottle of Sass Wine. Located in the South Salem Hills of Oregon's Willamette Valley, Sass Wine produces small amounts of handcrafted, high-quality wines that include Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, and Rosé of Syrah. A perfect balance of full fruit with fine, supple tannins and firm acidity is what makes truly great wines, and you'll find that in every bottle of Sass wine you drink.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got Happier Hour. It's 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's bar bars, sips, and snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for Happier Hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our Happier Hour menu.
Sobu's Happier Hour, every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks, friends, for tuning in to the show today. As you know, if you're listening before, we are here once again at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. And once again, I am pleased to be chatting with my friend Pepper Bowen, who is the director of the Culinaria Program, part of the National Food and Beverage Foundation, and also soon to be my podcast mate on a on a new platform for podcasts.
Absolutely, absolutely. We are launching the Green Pepper Podcast, where we will be talking about environmental issues as they relate to food, environmental and food inequalities, injustice, really through a social justice lens, and called Green Pepper because I'm clever.
You are very clever. And we talked about the last time that you were on the show. We covered how you got the name Pepper, and I love the story. It was about doctors. You go back and listen to the previous podcast. I really like that, and it's cool because this platform here is sponsored by the National Food and Beverage Foundation, as we noted, and the Noel Drink Show, the show you're listening to right now, is also part of the podcast platform. So I'm very excited about that. I think we're going to do some cool stuff together.
I think so, too. I'm super excited about it.
Yeah. And you're getting ready to do your inaugural episode fairly soon of Green Pepper.
Fairly soon. We are putting the final touches on the organization of it all and hoping to have it up before the end of the month.
Yeah, that's great. And there's some really neat programming that's going to go on. Listeners obviously know this show has a bit of a back catalog, so we'll put probably a couple back shows on there. And 5 will get you 10. This is probably the first one officially on the platform, so that's going to be really neat. Stay tuned for that. More information coming about the podcast platform here at the National Food and Beverage Foundation and the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. But what we are going to talk about here today, Pepper, something that I think we maybe even kind of alluded to a little bit on the last one, is the role that New Orleans had. And it's always such a unique place here, but the role that New Orleans had during the Civil Rights Movement. This is kind of our jumping off point, I guess. We'll probably go any number of directions. But
because we can.
Because we can, and we do. You just said something off air to me that I think is really funny. The 4, 5, 6 times you and I have chatted in life, it has never been linear. We have never had
Agreed.
A linear conversation.
And yeah, it doesn't seem like it's going to happen.
Probably
just starting here, and we'll see where it takes us.
Here you go. We threw a dart and decided to start right here.
Yes.
So we're starting right here. And so during the Civil Rights Movement, New Orleans did play a really interesting role. And then there were freedom kitchens, right, to feed the activists that were coming into
right.
the region to, you know, go out and
sure.
be active.
Well, what's interesting to me in many ways, I guess to give a bit of a foundation, is that we did have a number of people who were coming in from outside of New Orleans in order to organize. They were utilizing New Orleans as their hub, their place to stand things up, whether that had been the Southern Christian Leadership Council or SNCC
yep.
or any of the others. They were starting here in many, many ways. And I've wondered for probably far too long for me not to have an answer why New Orleans, but popular view is that maybe it was just a place for them to relax a little bit, that it would have been far more interesting to organize here and then go out for maybe a drink and some dancing, just some partying, than say Pascagoula. But
right.
Whether that happened, we don't actually know. What we can say is that the Freedom Riders, as well as the other organizers, would have needed some place to live while they were in town, sleep rather. They would have also needed some place to eat. And these are often things that folks don't really consider. The sleeping part, yeah, you can sleep on somebody's floor, but where are you getting something to eat? And I went over to the New Orleans Historic Collection and looked at their green book that they do have on file. So if anybody wants to go, you absolutely should go. The green book was the travel directory that was available to folks, African-American folks, Black folks who were traveling through the South. Well, in fact, all over the 50 states, where it was acceptable, as well as you would have been welcome in these places. Now, whether that would have been a restaurant or a hotel, maybe even there were some gas stations that were listed, cabs that were listed there. And so all of those things are all well and good until you are actually in that space for an extended period of time, because as we both know, you can only eat out for so long and for so often. Mm-hmm. So where else is this happening?
And a lot of, and Pepper, obviously, like, as you're saying, a lot of these people who are activists, it's not like you're coming in bankrolled by a lot of money either.
True enough.
Real, you know, you're on a shoestring doing
you
this
are
stuff.
Indeed. And so one of the places that they were not only sleeping but eating was at Virgie Castle's place. And Virgie Castle, who unsung hero in many, many ways. She was, most known for two things. One, for being Aretha Castle, then Haley's mother, and also for working at Dookie Chase's. She had the Freedom Kitchen right here in town, and what she would do was to allow these folks, these Freedom Riders, to come in and stay at her place. They would organize around a kitchen table and have dinner. And although that does seem really, uncommon for those people who don't actually organize, I can say from personal experience that organizing around a table is absolutely the way that
that's
it.
What you do, right? I mean, you sit around with food and drink, and I mean, and,
true
and
story.
This is the time that you do this.
True
yeah,
story.
Absolutely.
So personal vignette, I actually had some folks over for dinner Sunday night, and we were just talking politics, and the food was full to bursting. There, the table actually seats 8. We had 12, and despite the fact that I deliberately had enough seats in the living room, not a single person left the table. So we climbed over each other and passed things to each other and just ate for hours upon end. And it was quite possibly the best dinner that I've had in at least 3 weeks.
That's great. And at least 3 weeks. That sounds pretty good. I want to hear about the one 3 weeks prior to that.
At least.
Because that sounds like a great dinner. And that actually makes sense, too. It's, I think there's a vibe, too, when you leave the table and maybe you retire to the living room.
Sure.
That's kind of when you want. Like, I'm now kind of done with the heavy lifting.
Yes, but we can't because we need to continue to eat. Yes.
Yeah, right. Exactly. just put on the game and give me a beer. Leave me alone now that I'm sitting on the couch.
Right. You know. So the fact that it actually happened at Virgie Castle's place, I think, is informative as to how it is that Dookie Chase became the place where we know of a lot of organizing and activists and celebrities showing up in order to lend their support to the civil rights movement. Again, as far as we know, either Virgie Castle was a barmaid or she was a waitress at Dookie Chase's. I don't think that it's coincidental that Dookie Chase's began to be the place to go and the place to be in New Orleans for this sort of activity. Dookie Chase's was uniquely positioned in that it was an integrated restaurant in many ways, so that there were folks who were not only police officers, but also government employees who would eat there who were not people of color. And then they became more prominent in the respect that they were drawing in folks who were large celebrities at the time. So think Harry Belafonte, Nina Simone, who were not only lending their voices, but also their political weight to fighting against the injustices of not just the voting rights, but a litany of other causes. So as we talk about how it is that folks were organizing, where they were organizing, there's not a whole lot of information as to what kitchens were being used or what homes were being used beyond Virgie Castle.
And this makes sense
because it was intended to be clandestine, right? So
right.
I am currently, if anyone's interested in filling out an application, looking for a, not a research librarian, but a conspiratory librarian to help me identify where these places were. So yeah, the information that we have is exceedingly limited because it was meant to be clandestine, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we do know in many ways, especially if you start looking at the Green Book, is to give just a frame of reference, that most of the information or the chronicle is written through the lens of a white guy who's not from here, who may have gotten funding to come down and write on jazz. So if you hear about, say, the Little Jim Saloon, excuse me, which may have been a place for integration to be active, to actually occur, that may not and reasonably would not have been a place where there would have been doing a lot of organizing and activist movement.
And one would think, Pepper, too, even if it was, that was not, as you said, it's not going to be on the radar of the person chronicling this.
Right.
You know?
Right. So if you're not in the loop, you're just not in the loop.
Pepper, do me one favor. Let's hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break and come right back, okay?
Yes.
Friends, stay tuned to the Noel Drink Show. We're going to take a quick break. We're chatting with Pepper Bowen. Come on back.
The French Market is open daily with pop-up fresh markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays. The Crescent City Farmers Market is at the French Market each Wednesday, rain or shine, from 2 to 6 p.m. On Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., find new and different vendors offering everything from fresh bagels to fresh herbs. Vendors change weekly depending on weather and seasons, so check them out often. Visit frenchmarket.org for a list of farmers market vendors, chef demonstrations, live music, and special events.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street. Or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with New Orleans' own Sazerac Company, makers of Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In case you haven't noticed, rye whiskey is hot, flying off store shelves and dominating the bar scene in New Orleans and around the country. Rye's spicy and assertive character is drawing in those looking for whiskey with a bite, but that equally pairs well with cocktails. Enjoy it in cocktails like the Old Fashioned or Manhattan, or simply savor it on the rocks. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. If you're listening to this show, you love good food and good wine. And a great wine with our plentiful fresh Gulf seafood is the Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc, a crisp, balanced white blend from the south of France. Whether it's with fresh oysters, crab, redfish, or shrimp, this Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc will not disappoint. And it's a great value at around $14. Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc. Cheers.
Hello, this is Ron Bartholomew, and to my great city of New Orleans, I'd like to introduce to you Touch Vodka. This artisan handcrafted ultra-premium vodka is uniquely distilled from Florida's finest wildflower honey and American grain. Touch also produces key lime, Valencia orange, and ruby red grapefruit selections that are infused with natural oils of locally sourced fruit, which results in a unique 80-proof vodka with no sugar added or coloring. Touch is now available at Doranax, Cello's, and the Corporation Grill and Bar, and many other locations across Louisiana. This holiday season, sit back and relax and enjoy Touch Vodka.
Top Taco and Gambit present the first ever Agave Week in New Orleans, kicking off with the world's largest Bloody Maria bar at Superior Grill on Sunday, March 11th. Featured events include paired dinners and tequila tastings at some of the best restaurants and bars in the city. Agave Week culminates on Thursday, March 15th, with Top Taco, sponsored by Corona and the Paddle Wheeler Creole Queen at Waldenburg Park. 40 restaurants, 60 cocktails, and over 100 different tequilas will compete. The event benefits local foster children through One Heart NOLA. Check out toptaconola.com for tickets and more information.
Every afternoon when I wake up,
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. We're chatting with Pepper Bowen here, and we are here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, as you know. And Pepper, you were just saying, we were talking about like a lot of the chronicling that we get of some of the integrated cultural history here is really told through music, because that was what was going on. Like, we're talking about Little Jim Saloon and things like that, and that was maybe not on the radar of people. A white guy coming from somewhere else to write about tunes is not going to... The meeting could have been happening at a table right next to him, and he was probably going, dude, listen to what Lewis is playing. I have no idea.
Well, and so that is absolutely a theory, which I did have for a time. What I've gotten to you now is that... reasonably, it just would have been in walking distance. So if these folks were coming in from out of town, whether they took the train or they took the bus, they would have ended up being largely pedestrian once they got into town. So whatever organizing would have occurred in the same neighborhood as where they were staying and where they were eating. And then, you know, just to sort of blow off some steam at the end of the night, reasonably, they would have just gone to a neighborhood bar. Now, that's no different than what happens right now, right? So you go to the bar that's closest to your house, and then God bless, that is the best bar ever, because, you know, driving across town is not always the most efficient thing to do. And if you consider how less mobile they were than we are today, so even calling for a taxi would have generated a good deal of thought. There would not have been the ability to just hop on an Uber or hop in an Uber or a Lyft and get a ride home. Calling somebody to come and pick you up also would have been complex. So like whether somebody actually had a phone in their house. And so I don't think that there would have been a lot of movement across town. There would have been a lot of movement in and out of neighborhoods. I think that especially when we start talking about organizing and we're sitting around a kitchen, that all of those things would have happened in a very insular way, which, truth be told, would not have been different in large swaths of the way that neighborhoods were really constructed, right? So we lived in a neighborhood where we worked and we bought everything that we needed because they were self-contained. Especially as we think about the food access issues and food businesses, every neighborhood had everything that it needed. And it wasn't until several years later that that model started to change.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we're talking about a situation, too, where you're working, you're with the people with whom you're working.
Right.
You're going to stay close to those people, one would think.
Safety.
And it's safety. And it's sort of working meetings, working time together, working meals together, all of that. And yeah, like you said, it's not, I'm going to pop in, let's go check out this bar in the Lower Garden District, and then let's go back and eat dinner over in the Treme. I mean, that's not what the case was.
Right.
We're on a budget. We're talking about all these things. And I'm also imagining that a lot of the situation is, too, is that time is of the essence. When people are here, you're here to organize for a period of time and then get out in the field and go do what you need to do.
Right. So especially when we were talking once before, I think, about the Freedom Rides, right? So there was a lot of organization that was going on here, that the Freedom Rides themselves were intended to start in D.C. and not end until they reached New Orleans. Mm-hmm. They just happened to stop in Alabama for many reasons. But, you know, I pass no judgment right now. I just say as a point of fact, they were intended to end here. Whether they were intended to end here is being just across the border of Mississippi, so that it wasn't that far away, and this would have been the place where they could more easily go out, have a drink, and celebrate their victory, or whether this was just a place to recap, so to get back to HQ in many ways, we may not know until I finish doing research. However,
it logically makes sense, right?
Yeah,
there's infrastructure
the
here,
makes sense.
The process makes sense. Yep, go on, I'm sorry.
No. I was just saying that the process does make sense, and so the eating along the way would have been heavily orchestrated as to how it is that who is providing the food, where they're getting the food to them, and that sort of thing. It's not terribly different when we start thinking about just Black people traveling on trains going through the South. Or conversely, Black people who were selling from the train stations to folks who were traveling by train, right? So I was just having this conversation. As I say, I speak probably a lot about food. Just having a conversation about how there were women in Mississippi who were selling peanuts at train stations, whether it was to augment their income or to save or whatever the case might happen to have been. I have not verified the assertion that that was going on during the era of slavery, so I cannot say that is true. But what I do know is that they were on the platforms selling their peanuts to folks as they were coming through town. At some point, some of those train routes were actually rerouted in order to ensure that they did not have an opportunity to save or buy or do whatever it is that they wanted to do, which I find fascinating.
Really?
Because we have, yeah, well, I find it fascinating because what we have, especially like when you think about, when I think about.
when one.
Yes, one who sits around thinking about food. When. When one sits around thinking about food, there are a number of small towns that actually live, that were bolstered, that were fueled by, that were only the creation of a train route.
Right.
So once the train has moved out of that town, the entire, it may have taken a couple years, but the entire town dies, meaning that all of the industry that's available moves somewhere else because it's harder to get anyone and anything that you actually need there. But I also find it interesting that a very similar tact was taken, say, here in New Orleans, where there were women who were selling baked goods or candies or what have you in Congo Square, also mm-hmm. with the same premise of saving or purchasing, if not their freedom, then purchasing, you know, something else.
And this was a place, and not to jump ahead, but let's jump ahead. This Congo Square, Congo Square was a place where this, in some fashion or another, I'll use the word loosely, was sanctioned so that you could sell your wares on the side,
sure.
if you will, in a way that that was at least, I'll use the word loosely again, permitted.
Right. Well, so again, with a little bit of foundation, mm-hmm. the Anglo-Saxons who were owners of people or slaves from North U.S., no, not North America, from the Northern U.S. and mm-hmm. from the Northeast, and who came down this way, say, post-Louisiana Purchase, were aghast at how the Europeans, the Spaniards, and the French had such a lazy way of dealing with their slaves. Now, what is also a cultural difference is steeped in some bit of policy for the Spanish from the Spanish perspective, the slaves were owned by the crown. And so this whole idea of beating and maiming the slave was not an option. But
that was supposed to be the state, technically the state that doled out the punishment, not the slave owner.
Right. And so to harm, to maim, to kill the slave that is owned by the crown is then a direct offense against the crown.
Right.
So there was not the same approach to slavery. Now, I'm not suggesting that it was any nicer to be a slave under a Spanish owner than it would have been any other. What I am saying is that, as a matter of fact, that was not permitted. And so in the grand scheme of things, this entrepreneurial sort of view that we or the lens through which we look at it is them being entrepreneurial and selling on the train platforms as well as in places like Congo Square would have been an opportunity that was I hesitate to say the word given, but allowed, permitted, tolerated, probably.
That's a good word. I keep saying sanctioned or permitted, but that's...
Right. And I'm reaching for exactly what the right level is, but tolerated for sure, that on their day off, that they would be able to sell whatever it was that they could. And so like, what it was that they sold is also fairly interesting to me. Because just like I was saying with this conversation a couple days ago, the peanuts were a groundnut, they grew wild. And so for people, whether it be men, women, or children, to go out and pick peanuts and then sell them on train platforms would not have been a large investment of anything save time, as opposed to, say, a praline, which would have been an investment of not just sugar, but also pecans and the time.
And the preparation, right, exactly.
Right, so, yeah.
Pepper, let's take a quick break. We'll come right back.
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to take a little break here on the show, friends. Come on back.
sitting here la la waiting for my ya-ya.
Hey ladies, are you looking for wine to bring to your next girls night out? Grab a bottle of Capitello wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from. Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, dessert wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello wine. Cheers.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here at the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. We are here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum on Rethel-Cassahaley Boulevard, and we are chatting with Pepper Bowen, the director of the Culinaria program here. And I have to ask you, Pepper, really quickly before we jump back into what we were talking about. So it is Aretha. Everybody here says Aretha.
Well, I said Aretha too, but then I saw this documentary that was done by Xavier, and it's called A House Divided.
Uh-huh.
And I want to say it was 93 or 80 something. Well, whatever it was, you can actually get it at the Amistad Center over at Tulane to view. I want to say it's on, I don't remember what it's on, what platform it's on, whether it's a DVD or a VHS. I'm hoping that by now somebody's put it on a DVD.
You got to have transferred by this point. Yeah.
Right. That's my theory. But you can also watch it on YouTube. And so when I watched it, everybody else pronounced it Aretha, and I didn't understand that because I had grown up hearing and thinking that it was Aretha. But you know, there we are.
Okay, very good. We're gonna roll with Aretha. So we were talking about when we took the break. I hate to use this, and you know, it's funny, Pepper, because we're talking about this. We're sort of dancing around these terminologies. You know, I would say if you're enterprising, you may find an opportunity to go sell peanuts at a train station platform or pralines in Congo Square,
right?
And that's applying our revisionist lens to these things. But I guess it's working language that we need to use to describe.
Well,
you're looking
yeah.
for economic opportunity, perhaps to better your situation, or
yeah, to an extent,
to
right?
An extent.
So, I use all of my SAT words because I still owe student loans. And I figure right. I might as well be getting some mileage out of them. Additionally, I think it's far too pedestrian to just call these people slaves and to just say that they were selling things, and it, which implies
like
that,
automatons, right? And that's not what this
right.
It's
not it implies that not
here.
Only are they automatons, but deeper than that, that there's really no thought process involved, that there was no ingenuity that came through their work, that they thought nothing about it, that they took information that was given to them by someone else and then just applied it, as opposed to creating the entire structure themselves. So,
and creating structure on the margins of life that you're seemingly handed in a structural fashion, right?
Agreed.
If that
right?
makes sense, you know, I
yeah.
mean, there
so,
are these spaces that you find to do things.
True.
And you do them. I mean,
right.
if you're that person.
Right. So I was having a conversation, and I was saying that the entrepreneurial spirit of African women, I believe that the selling of pralines in Congo Square was really a continuation of a story, say the commercialism that would have gone on with trade routes in Northern Africa, pre-colonial Africa, that the trade, that the women who were selling in the marketplace there, that there's some sort of a tie that brings that information forward, that spirit forward to these American-born enslaved people or free women of color to decide that they would then sell pralines in Congo Square on their Sunday day off, right? So they're working in their off time, and that could not have been fun. Right. Even now, I mean, what I do is click a mouse for a living most of the time, and it's still not fun working on my off time. And mm-hmm. just imagining what that translates into in reality, what they were doing and how it was that they were doing it. And then spending that one day.
Mm-hmm. Carting it to Congo Square. Exactly. You're not hopping in an Uber with your, exactly. with your ice chest full of tamales.
There's no FedEx dropping it off. No. There's no commercial kitchen available. You're walking through town.
Can I leave this here until next week?
Exactly. Yeah. Right? And so, like I said, I believe that there's a continuation of the story, because not only were there African American women, whether they be free women of color or some derivation of the African diaspora, who not only sold there, but then moved forward throughout the rest of our history, coming to present day, who continue to create, to innovate, to make something out of nothing. I don't know why it popped into my head, but trying to make a dollar out of 15 cents, that they are creating this environment in which they can survive because there's not an alternative. And so anyways, what I was saying was that the woman with whom I was speaking, she said that I'm looking at it through a very capitalist lens. And I could do nothing but defer to her, because I am. When I say that it's entrepreneurial, it suggests to me that they are looking for an opportunity to build and to move forward and to grow. And she was saying that if, on the other hand, we were to accept, which is absolutely true, that their bodies, their work, their labor, their children, their very, everything that they had been monetized by someone else. Mm-hmm. All they had left was creativity and whatever skill sets that they possessed. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we got to them selling pralines over time in this, in the marketplace, or selling harvested or scavenged legumes and nuts at train stations, this isn't necessarily a choice so much as it is an act of
necessity.
Last resort.
Yeah, necessity, right?
Yes. So as a last resort, they sell what they have. They take time, which is the only thing that reasonably they possess, right? Mm-hmm. Their ingenuity. What do I know how to do? Well, you know, I cook, I make pralines, I know how to do that.
I can get my hands on some amount of resource because it's around me in some fashion.
Yep. However that happens, and then I sell what I have on my day. I take some of it to save for future, and then the rest of it goes back into either buying new products, or certainly wasn't marketing, but definitely it would be the whatever it is, your transport system, in order to get it there, and packaging. So yeah, the lens through which we frame this is completely modern, but it's the best that I can do with the language that I have available to me in order to convey what it was that they were actually doing, as opposed to how it is frequently positioned.
You know, Pepper, you raise a really interesting point, and not to go too far off on this tangent, but you and I were chatting about this before we started recording. And I've always kind of struggled with this concept, is that, you know, to talk about it, say, from a capitalist lens, or talk about it through a socialist lens, in my mind is almost irrelevant, because the people that we're talking about in the reality of that time is not going, let me think about what I'm doing today through what Karl Marx thought about it and Engels thought about
very
it
true.
Versus let me think about, nah, you know, I'm going to put my Adam Smith hat on today and I'm going to look at it that way. I mean, that it's our interpretation that helps us make sense of it.
Agreed.
And that the philosophical framework is just the philosophical framework.
Agreed. It is a philosophical framework. But if we look at even without a label, even without a categorization of how it is that you're doing what you're doing, the more communal, meaning everyone in the boat, we are rowing this way together. And if that means that we're saving up for one thing as a household or as a community or as a neighborhood.
There's always been economy in some form or another.
Right.
Right.
As opposed, which is more a socialist construct, right? So
absolutely.
We are working together as opposed to a capitalist construct, which loosely would mean that I am making money and then I have some other people come in and do the same thing. I take part of mm-hmm. what they make for myself and not do the
right.
work. So
right.
I do I hesitate to say that, you know, whether it be one political system versus another, but what I can say for sure is that the way that they lived was far more communal and far more accepting, was far more supportive than the way that we do now, mainly because as we commercialize things and as we monetize things, there is a mindset that there's not enough for all of us.
Right. Scarcity and what, and you're absolutely right. And I think, and just finishing the point that I was making is I think when you read any of these, you know, you read the Communist Manifesto, you read Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith, they're all really fine on paper. They're great arguments. They're flawless. But in reality and in practice, neither one of them, you know, particularly works, because there's things like human nature and reality and other things that come in, and our inability to actually quantify things properly and all kinds of other things that don't really work, you know. And
That's a whole nother conversation.
That's a whole nother conversation. But I just think, you know, my point is that applying it to people's existence at the time is just a convenience for our way to explain it versus a way of what was going through anyone's head.
Right. Well, especially for folks who didn't have the right to vote, the unfortunate circumstance is that, no, on in application, a lot of the political systems that are amazing as in concept don't work because of greed.
Right.
And so,
but do me a favor. Let's hold that thought. We're going to come right back on that. I got to take a quick break. Friends, stay tuned. Come on back.
Looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. Want a great alternative to Over Oak Chardonnay? Try Yamhill Valley Vineyards Pinot Blanc, a wonderfully balanced white wine from the oldest family estate in McMinnville, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. It's round and ripe like a Chardonnay, but without the heavy oak and sweetness of big commercial corporate Chardonnays. Yamhill Valley Vineyard Pinot Blanc, a great value under $20. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Tim McNally, welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, friends, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you on the NOLA Drinks Show, and it's WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land. We are chatting with Pepper Bowen, and we just left off Pepper talking about political systems, and not so much that we need to go too far down this road, but we were talking about, you know, greed and these things and how that, you know, that just tends to get human nature. I mean, we'll chalk it up maybe that way. Tends to get, not everybody's greedy, but varying degrees.
All right.
Degrees, maybe.
How about we'll temper that with not necessarily greed so much as the investment is an investment in self as opposed to an investment in the collective.
Yeah.
So even if they have nothing today, what they are investing is the idea that one day I will have and I won't want to give it up for everyone else or for the collective. So this how often do I quote or even reference Ayn Rand, but the individual versus the collective then becomes something very complicated. However, the looking at the world through the lens of an individual is how I would argue we got slavery to start.
Yeah, you're right. That's a very fair assessment to say. I mean, absolutely. Well, so, you know, and, that'll be topics for other times or conversations for you and I to have in an non-linear fashion over drinks.
Yay!
Which we do. But, so anything that we want to circle back on then talking about selling pralines in Congo Square and
oh, goodness me. I'd forgotten we were even talking
that's
about
kind,
that.
So, yeah, that's kind of where we were sort of, you know, because we started to kind of get down this road of talking about, you know, the how do we define the, I hate to use this term, but how do we define the development of the market and the activity
sure.
in the first place?
Right. Well, so as the story goes, the women who were selling things were selling a variety of candies, and it as the market bore, pralines happened to be the thing, one of the few things that were the most popular, and so it wasn't the only thing. So, I'm still trying to figure out why or how we got to a space, and so I've equipped with a research librarian, an actual research librarian, who was helping me find out the ins and outs and connect these dots. That you don't wake up on a Tuesday morning and decide, you know what I'm going to do is to, one, make pralines, and two, sell them for my freedom. So yeah, pralines are not the sort of thing you happen upon, right? So anybody who's ever made pralines, you know that that is a very delicate process. You can happen mm-hmm. upon caramel, right? So you overcook the sugar, and next thing you know, right. you've got that. But right. But pralines are a delicate thing. And so best I can understand, there was at one point, or still is, but there's an indigenous dessert that was in the Texas territory when it included Mexico, and it was made with a sort of caramelized honey that had nuts like pepitas inside of it, and so they still make it. I don't know what the name of it is because I am completely unprepared for this moment, and so
we'll look into it.
What I'm thinking right now, and the theory is that, you know, Texas and Mexico being essentially next door, that there would not have been a clear delineation between culture and foodstuffs. So even a trade of, or you intermarriage, and then we can start talking immigration and how, like, what the patterns are, who comes from where, and why sure. do they go in different places. So if they would have been coming from points west mm-hmm. of here and moving in through, say, the southwest part of Louisiana, and
coming
going,
or by boat coming out of Galveston, New Orleans, I mean, right. anything.
Yeah. And then traveling, if not through the Mississippi River, going straight up north, mm-hmm. or even if they were going northeast, the bottom line is that at some point that technique ended up over here. And maybe sugar was just a substitution. That it is reasonable to understand that if you could not get honey, but you knew that you needed something sweet, a sugar cane was available and grown here en masse, that you could indeed bring sugar to the same point of near caramelization, but certainly when you cook it to a near point as you would have the honey, and not necessarily having pumpkin seeds, but having, praline started with almonds in them, but moved to pecans because that was more readily available, putting the pecans inside of the pralines as opposed to these other things. And so then it becomes a dish in and of itself that is simply evolved from another place.
Mm-hmm. That makes, I mean, and we know here in Louisiana, like anywhere, this is not unique to Louisiana or unique to New Orleans, that you're maybe adapting something that you're familiar with to local ingredients.
Sure.
These considerations. And so it's what's around you. And then, and also you're maybe making something that is somewhat, as you said, delicate to make, but somewhat portable and transportable. They're not
Absolutely.
Particularly heavy. They're not going to spoil.
Sure.
You can, you know, carry them to
yeah.
market in a, and sell them in a bite-sized piece, perhaps?
Yeah, and I mean, it wasn't just, like I said, it wasn't just those, it wasn't just those candies. There were other candies, including coconut candies that they were cooking. And as I think about it, especially the coconut, right? So I remember reading an article about Pappy Van Winkle.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And we're talking about the bourbon, friends.
Yes, yes, we are. So the story was written in, I can't remember what magazine, and the idea was that it went beautifully, or paired beautifully, with a coconut cake. And I want to say that this was up in Georgia somewhere.
Okay.
And It seems reasonable, right?
That, yeah, there's a sweeter note on Pappy Van Winkle. And,
right,
and,
but the
and,
thing yeah. is that even in Georgia, that coconut flakes, as they would have been imported, coconut flakes would have been expensive.
Yeah.
So not everybody would be able to afford coconut flakes. But, I mean, to be fair, sugar was also a bit of a luxury item. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until it started being granulated and you know, distributed widely, that it became a household thing. So if we're talking about things that were being sold there, whether it was the pralines or any sort of other sort of luxury thing, even the challis were fried balls of rice mm-hmm. that were easily transportable. Mm-hmm. We would have had a lot of rice, we still do here in Louisiana. And so these were also things that were sold. And there were those folks who actually had little plots of earth where they were growing their kitchen gardens, they may have and likely did convert some of that produce into something saleable.
That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, and I think too, even from, and maybe this is my own sweet tooth talking, but you think about it from just a pure enjoyment standpoint, and we're using Congo Square as an example. If Sunday is the one day that you get off and you're going to go be around members of your community, you're going to mm-hmm. go be around your peers, having something sweet to eat as a treat also fits that mold of the
sure,
day.
Sure. What I am still rather curious about, and I haven't done nearly enough research on, is the clientele, right? So who
could afford to buy and who actually has money
exactly,
in their pocket.
Right? Yeah. So, I mean, even if you are just, if you're hanging out and you are playing the drums, you are worshiping, you are fellowshipping, you're singing, and you are experiencing what it means just to have even a couple hours of, if not joy, then certainly relief.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily translate into disposable income, mm-hmm. right? So I do not want anybody to get the impression this was like a food mall where you'd walk in and you'd find a number of pop-ups and some, you know, there's a window or at least a table where you hand over your $2 or $3 and you get some desserts with on the side of something. I need you to be clear.
I'm imagining so-and-so's praline food cart.
Right.
That's the pre-food
truck
era.
Right. Right. And so that said, So what I'm actually very curious as to, yeah, and I do know that they did walk through the streets and sell. I'm actually very curious as to who was at, and I know some folks in town who do have this answer to, or the answer to that question. I just don't possess it. Mm-hmm. As to what it was that, and who was at Congo Square buying things. I mean,
we do know that people at a certain period in time, right, in Congo Square, where you did have free people of color that were going to Congo Square as well, and they would have some disposable income.
Absolutely.
Potentially
they did have their own income, and you know, Treme being most famous for having the neighborhood where there were highly skilled tradesmen, there right. were folks who, many of whom had been educated abroad, right. there may have been folks who were maybe working in some other realms, but you know, also this whole idea of things that are infrequently talked about, if they owned people of their own, were they subletting them to larger owners? So
right, let's do this, let's take another break, okay, we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more. Friends, come on back to the NOLA Drink Show.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bageau heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
Looking for a bottle of wine to impress your friends and family? Miro Cellars from California's Russian River Valley is the perfect wine for any occasion. Miro Cellars searches the region for the finest grapes to make their one-of-a-kind specialty wines. Award-winning winemaker Miro Chelikov considers the particular geology and seasonal climate of each vineyard when selecting the most interesting grapes the region has to offer. Because Miro has complete freedom to make precisely the wines he loves best, the results are spectacular. Let yourself in on one of the best-kept secrets in wine today. Mira Cellars.
Looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. We are chatting with our friend Pepper Bowen here, who is the director of the Culinaria Program here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, and actually technically, I should say, part of the National Food and Beverage Foundation. And we were talking a little bit, Pepper, kind of finishing these thoughts here on selling candies in Congo Square. More research is needed, as you noted, as far as finding out what some of these answers are.
Right. And so this is, in the interest of full disclosure to everyone listening, I was telling Brian earlier that this is my latest distraction, is trying to put the pieces together to how all of these things happened, whether it was entrepreneurial spirit, whether it was just a matter of desperation and ingenuity, or whether it was something just as simple as, you know what, this is what we got, this is what we're doing. And I don't have all of the answers, but the preliminary research has brought me to this place. And so as we were, I was talking a second ago about disposable income, and I was saying that theoretically, yeah, folks over in Treme would have had disposable income, theoretically. Mm-hmm. But, you know, whether it was that you were a tradesman or you were a relatively well-educated person, maybe you taught, maybe you owned other people, maybe you subletted your slaves, maybe you subletted your children. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is all the same, right? So you're not doing these things because you have money. You're doing these things because you need to make money, mm-hmm. right? So the difference certainly between being well off or being wealthy or rich or having money and not having money is that those who have money, their money works for them. Those who have no money, they work for their money, right? So if they were indeed you just sort of rolling in dough, they would not have had to do all of these other things, and they would have reasonably been able to have other people work for them. And then, yeah, sure, they could have hung out over at Congo Square, their parasols aflutter, and you know, just buying all sorts of strange things. Again, not a food mall. Anyway,
right.
This sort of transition, into the marketplace, not necessarily because it was something that they wanted to do, but something that they could. Like I was saying earlier, mm-hmm. those folks who were up in Mississippi who were foraging for nuts and selling them on the train platforms, those folks who learned long ago how to forage for food and to make it so, was not because they didn't want to be in the marketplace and they didn't want to purchase food. In many instances, it was just because they had no alternative. So they were forced to figure it out.
A subsistence living, yeah.
Right. And so one of the things that springs to mind is back in the 60s when we were at the height of the civil rights movement and SNCC was being very productive and they were doing a lot or having a lot of success around voting rights, that the Mississippi lawmakers actually removed themselves from the federal government food assistance programs.
You are shifting very well back to what we were going to talk about in our original outline. So you did that smoothly. I'm sorry. I am derailing your smooth transition back to that. Like, you made it sound so organic. You know what springs to mind? you totally just made that work, Pepper. So nice job. Go on. Carry on.
Thank
sorry.
You. Okay.
fast forward to the 1960s.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got again, never linear, but here we are in the 1960s. And yeah, so Southern white lawmakers of Mississippi removed themselves from the federal food subsistence programs or food assistance programs. And the reason for that was that it was backlash over the voting rights successes. And so the idea of food being used as a weapon in order to continue to oppress and to compel black people into servitude is not a new thing. In fact, it's been going on for a long time.
Right.
And it certainly hasn't changed any. I mean, when you start fast forward again to current day, and there's discussion about, and this, again, please do not misunderstand that black people are the only people who receive food assistance or are part of food assistance programs, but for the context of this conversation, that SNAP programs are in danger of turning into something akin to a Blue Apron delivery is criminal.
Yep.
Which I probably should not say out loud, but here I've already done it. Yeah, so it is a disservice to those folks who are actually receiving assistance. And again, it is simply a way to continue to oppress millions, those who are easiest to target because they do not have a whole heck of a lot to start. And so by removing what little assistance there is, puts them in a position where they are off balance and can no longer focus on the things that they want to gain. They need to then double down and buttress against what it is that they have so that they can simply maintain. And it's been going on for a long time.
Yeah, and this pepper, and we'll, this is something we should probably do a future show on in the very near future, because also not to mention the quality or lack thereof of food in question in these types of situations and how that manifests.
Sure.
And all that. But bringing it back to what you were talking about before with using food as a weapon in the civil rights movement and what the white Mississippi lawmakers did. Can you elaborate on that just a little bit further?
So, if you think for a minute about what early 60s in Mississippi looked like, there were or had been a largely agrarian society or largely agrarian community for a long time. When you think about the Delta, that's exactly where it is. It's the richest earth that we have, or at least that we tout. And so they were heavily dependent upon agriculture. But this comes after a number of events, unfortunate or not, depending upon how you look at things, have occurred, right? So you've got the 1927 floods
the Great Flood of 1927.
Right, the Great Flood of 1927, which took acres upon acres of land all the way down the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. After that, there's the 1929 Depression, right? So the stock market crash.
Started the Great Depression, yeah.
Right? We've also got a number of people who at that point have already moved into the city. And so they're not necessarily in the country where they would have, where in those areas it was heavily dependent upon manual labor. However it is that you want to see that, whether it's slaves or sharecroppers. Mm-hmm. We also have a moment where we're moving into a world war where at that time, there is industry that is building, but it's not building in the South. It's building in the West. So the cotton that's necessary, the cotton that had been grown in that area for generations, is no longer being grown in those spaces.
Right.
They're growing much more on a smaller plot of earth in the West. So think California. They're giving government grants to those spaces as well as using machinery.
Coming in with mechanization from the beginning as opposed to having to retroactively use mechanization. Yeah.
And so in the South, there are acres upon acres upon acres of land that's left untouched. And so when we get back to this whole idea of politics and capitalism, the only way for the landowners to make money is by compelling the black people who happen to be there to work the land. Mm-hmm. There's land that may not be giving anything to begin with. It may be a lot of land that would I can honestly, I can say that I've used the euphemism. It's a tough row to hoe,
yeah.
But I've never actually hoed a row of anything. Mm-hmm. So I can only imagine what that looks like and what that feels like at the end of the day, because it's just you and a hoe and you are the machinery.
Machine. Yep.
In order to make this, to till the land,
right.
To plant the seeds.
Make it fertile, to make it
to
produce.
To do all of these things that are necessary. And so there's not a whole lot, right? But again, in the structure that they had, in order for the landowner to make anything, it is imperative that the blacks who were there actually continue to work the land. And there would have been some poor whites doing the same, but it was no different if you think about it on a more systemic scale, it was no different here in the South or next door in Mississippi than it was for the produce pickers who were working of all walks of life in California.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. As we're moving through, what ends up happening is that there's not enough money being made by the landowners, and so they continue to figure out ways in order to make money, and that is at the expense of those folks who are actually working the land. When those folks who are working the land attempt to register to vote, a couple of things happen. One is that they're turned off of the land altogether, which means that not only do they no longer have a place to live, but they also don't have a livelihood. Mm-hmm. So where do they go and what do they do? If they do...
Pepper, hold the thought, because that's a good, not really a good place to stop, but we're going to stop, take a quick break, and come back and do more. Friends, okay. We're going to take a little break here on the Noel Drinks Show. Come on back.
Top Taco and Gambit present the first ever Agave Week in New Orleans, kicking off with the world's largest Bloody Maria bar at Superior Grill on Sunday, March 11th. Featured events include paired dinners and tequila tastings at some of the best restaurants and bars in the city. Agave Week culminates on Thursday, March 15th with Top Taco, sponsored by Corona and the Paddle Wheeler Creole Queen at Waldenburg Park. 40 restaurants, 60 cocktails, and over 100 different tequilas will compete. The event benefits local foster children through One Heart NOLA. Check out toptaconola.com for tickets and more information.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy, suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir from the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In 2008, the Louisiana legislature made the Sazerac cocktail the official cocktail of New Orleans, affirming what New Orleanians had known for over 150 years. You just can't beat a good Sazerac. The Sazerac cocktail is the quintessential New Orleans drink, perfect for celebrating the arrival of fall festivals, football season, or just being proud to be a New Orleanian. For the official recipe, visit www.sazerac.com.
The French Market offers daily entertainment and delicious food and drink options throughout our six-block district. Whether you crave raw oysters or fresh produce, authentic confections or healthy daiquiris, you can find it here. Sit at one of our cafes and hear live local music. Enjoy a muffaletta, po' boy, salad, or cheese plate in the farmer's market. Check out our pop-up farmer's markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays for even more fresh food options. History is being made fresh daily at the French Market. Visit frenchmarket.org for food, drink, retail, and event listings.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bageau heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
Get in the groove and let the good times roll. We're going to stay here to exude our soul. It takes all that long.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in today. We're chatting with Pepper Bowen here of the Culinaria program. And Pepper, we just left off talking about disenfranchising people essentially from their livelihood as it relates to voting and using that as a mechanism basically to disenfranchise people.
Right. Well, yeah. So like I was saying a minute ago, once these folks have been turned off their land or the land in which they live, as well as their livelihoods taken away, if they do find some shelter, some way to try to cobble together a place to lay their heads, it's still exceedingly difficult to get a job. It's still because now you're essentially blackballed and can't work until you decide that you're not going to want to vote, right? So that is your voice. If you want to exercise your voice, then you can't be here. And if you have no place else, it's also very difficult to want to exercise a voice. But more important than that, food. So if there is a space where you can be, it does not necessarily mean that there's enough food for you and the family with whom you're living. So food assistance programs became super popular, not for any other reason than they actually needed them to survive. They were not making tons of money, so it's not as if they could just go to the store. Many of them had maxed out on credit. And when we start thinking about the, quote, company store, the company stores were selling at a premium because they could, and they were also charging interest. So if you think about selling at a premium, think amusement parks, right? So there's no other place for you to get food, and they know it.
Right. Going to a ball game, that's why you can charge $12 for a beer.
Right.
Exactly. You're a cap. Jazz Fest. Oh, did I say that? Sorry, go on.
Additionally, when you start thinking about the interest on top of it, right? So think payday loans. They take out a little bit and they charge an absurd amount of money in interest. And so they continue this cycle.
Yeah.
Right. You continue this cycle of poverty and depression.
Yep.
So for the state legislators to get together and to decide the way to smoke them out, starve them out, whatever it is that you want to think of it, by removing the federal assistance programs, it was actually borderline ingenious, because originally the Freedmen's Rule, I can't think of the name of it, but it was the plan was post or during Reconstruction, post Civil War, end of the Civil War. It was for everybody, right? So white landowners and former slave owners then complained to their friends in the legislature, that blacks needed incentive to work. And if they were given food, then they would have no incentive. And so then that entire program, the entire program of Freedmen's Bureau was backed off. So instead of providing food to everyone in the South, mm-hmm. right, what they did was make it only for the disabled and for orphans. Mm-hmm. So that was the first round. And so we moved through from the Freedmen's Bureau into post-Reconstruction, the end of Reconstruction, into Jim Crow laws, where constitutions and the charters for states were, the laws in the states as well as the constitutions of the states were changed in order to support these ideas mm-hmm. that there would still be white supremacy, to paraphrase. And then we fast right. forward into a space under these rules where black people have fewer rights than they were intended to have under the amendments that were written, 14th, 15th, 16th Amendments.
And Plessy versus Ferguson, right? I mean, separate but equal, obviously, was
right.
Right. And we don't want to go, but that's...
No, we don't want to go there.
That's right for manipulation, right,
yeah,
in the situation.
For real, yeah. So, yeah, separate but not equal and all that was really how we got Brown v. Board of Education. And
right.
so, anyway, the whole idea of food being at the core, right? So, since Reconstruction, we've been trying, the collective of folks in power have been trying to starve out anyone who would dare use their voice and stand up and try to be an equal citizen, an equal person, or a person at all, right? Because not too long before then, they were only three-fifths of a person.
Right.
So that aside, mm-hmm. We get to the Civil Rights Movement, where we've got the Civil Rights Act, where we've got folks who are trying to fight for their voice to be heard through voting. And then there's a removal of this bouncy thing that you land on when you can't get it.
A trampoline or
I can't think of a
just
word.
Just trying to make a soft landing on something.
Yeah, that's the thing. Don't worry about it. Okay. We'll move past it. So anyway, so there's not a place for them to land. And so without that ability to eat, a lot of people have a tendency not to want to do anything else.
Yeah, because, I mean, that becomes your ultimate priority.
Right, because it's so. Absolutely, right? There are a lot of things you can live without, and food ain't one of them. Mm-hmm. So the idea was, again, just like post-Reconstruction, just like with Jim Crow laws, just like here in the Civil Rights era, starve them out.
Right. I mean, and that's, it strikes me very much as that's just a simple, I shouldn't say simple, that's not a good word, but a continuation of Jim. I mean, that was just another manifestation of Jim Crow to do that. Well, we have a few minutes left, Pepper, and we can obviously go down any number of these roads
on
this very, very light note, but it's fascinating conversation. We'll do this again because some of these things, I actually, talking about the SNAP program and some of these things are something I'd like to come back to and talk about in a future show. But in the last 3 minutes or so, 2 minutes we have left here, tell people where they can find the Southern Food and Beverage Museum and where they can find Culinaria online.
The Southern Food and Beverage Museum is located at the corner of Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard and Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard in Central City. And Culinaria Center is online at www.culinariacenter.org.
Awesome. And we can look for the Green Pepper podcast coming up
fairly
soon. and that'll be great. You're going to have me as a guest on the podcast sometime,
heck
right?
Yeah.
Awesome.
I cannot wait. I think it's going to be amazing because I really want to have a talk about the legislation around alcohol, right?
Okay.
So bathtub gin and how all that sort of played into it. Not absinthe so much because, you know, it's not as accessible, I don't think.
Right.
But yeah, that and some whiskey.
And that would be great. And I'll be happy to talk about Red Fanta also, which is sorry, friends, I'll maybe elaborate that as we close out the show here, just so you don't, I don't leave you hanging. But Pepper, thanks so much for being here. I really appreciate it. It was a very enjoyable chat as always. What we'll do next time is we'll get together at Barrel Proof, drink some whiskey, talk about what we're going to talk about on the show, and then not talk about it.
Fair point.
But thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate
it. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Brian.
Absolutely. Friends, we're going to take a break here on the Noah Drink Show. Once again, we're going to be back to close things out. Come on back.
Yeah, my book has got a hole in it. My book has got a hole in it. I can't find no beer.
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. Try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu, life is meant to be lived, not endured.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Yes, friends, thank you so much for tuning in
to the NOLA Drinks Show. I really appreciate it. Always a pleasure to have you listening, whether you're listening here on the radio, of course, on WGSO, as I just said, or you're catching us anywhere that you may be in podcast land. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Pepper. Always a fascinating conversation, as you probably gathered leading in from the top of the show if you heard the whole thing. Wide-ranging conversation, very interesting conversation. We will certainly have Pepper on again talking about different things. And that intersection of food, politics, certainly in this case, talking about the civil rights movement, so food, politics, race, interesting stuff. It's a huge amount of information and discussion topic material to get through. And so actually, that's why I wanted to have this featured interview be quite as extensive as it was, just basically to be able to basically be nonlinear, as I was saying at the top of the show, and move around from topic to topic. And we'll keep you posted on Pepper's research that she does, going further into some of the stuff that we talked about. For example, the African-American women selling pralines in Congo Square. I think it's just incredibly fascinating and incredibly important stuff for us to know, especially here. It's important stuff for us to know anytime, of course, and not just during Black History Month, like I was going to say, but it is Black History Month here in February. So there you go. Friends, mention too, just to make sure that you do check out her podcast, Green Pepper, when it launches. We'll let you know when that happens. That, of course, is going to be part of the National Food and Beverage Foundation podcast platform, of which, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we are also a part. Very honored to do that. Some other good shows that are in the pipeline that are going to be a part of that as well. So lots of good stuff there. Okay. Yeah. So, hey, wanted to mention a little bit about the James Beard Awards that just came out. The semifinalists have been announced at this point. And what will happen from here is the semifinalists get whittled down a little bit further to the actual finalists. And we'll know who those are. I believe, what is it, March 14th is when they announce the finalists. And then the later on in May, I believe, is when early May, when the James Beard Awards Gala takes place in Chicago, they'll announce the actual winners. 14 different establishments have been honored or nominated as a semifinalist here from New Orleans. I think that's a pretty good representation. I'm a little biased. I think there could probably be a little bit more, but let me run some of these down for you. In the best new restaurant category, we had one, and that was Saffron, these Indian cuisine, I think a little bit of fusion going on there uptown. Once again, Cure, the outstanding bar, craft cocktail bar on Ferret Street, also in uptown in New Orleans, is nominated. I believe this may be the second or third time they have been nominated. That's our friend Neil Bodenheimer and gang there, who also operates Cane and Table. Once again, Donald Link, who has been nominated before for Herb Saint, is nominated in the Outstanding Chef category. I should say Cure is, of course, nominated in the Outstanding Bar Program category. Outstanding Pastry Chef, got another one in that category. That's Kelly Fields at Willa Jean. In the Outstanding Restaurateur category, we've got one there. That is for Joanne Clevenger for Upper Line Restaurant. Good news on that front. Good work there. Once again, Brightson's has been nominated in the Outstanding Service category. There you go. Very deserving. Their service is impeccable. Outstanding Wine Program. Very cool. Our friends there at Bacchanal in the Bywater, a very fine wine bar, food place, music venue, all kinds of good stuff going on there. Go check them out. It's a really cool place to hang out. Outstanding Wine Program for them. That's great. And then they break down at this point through the semifinals, they break down Best Chef by region. So no small surprise in the southern region, we have a handful. So it looks like we got seven. Nina Compton of Compare La Pan is nominated. Kristen Essig and Michael Stoltzfus of Coquette. Michael Galata of Maypop, also who operates Mofo, in this case nominated for Maypop. Slade Rushing there at Brennan's in the Corner. Hu Tan from Kin, that's cool, nominated. Isaac Toops for Toops Meadery. They also operate Toops South, of course. He's nominated for the Meadery. And Martha Wiggins, my good buddy, who was nominated for the Rising Star Chef category last year there at Sylvain, is also nominated for Best Chef in the South region. Martha's going to be moving on very shortly from Sylvain. We're sad to see her go, but she's going to be moving on to bigger and better things. Couldn't be prouder and happier for her. As I said, she's a good pal of mine. Like to see everybody there is very deserving. A lot of those folks are acquaintances or friends of mine. But yeah, I want to say that Martha's my pal. So that's who I got in this. So there you go. So check that out. We'll, of course, keep you up to date on how things proceed. And when the semifinalists whittle down a little bit further, we will most certainly let you know about that. Some other beverage news, friends, that I want to mention. We had Neil Bodenheimer on the show, aforementioned there of Cure. And Neil had been working with the Solomon family to acquire Tales of the Cocktail. You may know this. Tales of the Cocktail, of course, is the largest cocktail and spirits industry conference in the world. Takes place about the third weekend of July every year here in New Orleans. All kinds of controversy beset Tales, the previous operators, Ann and Paul Tunnerman. We've talked about this a lot on the show. You can go back and listen to back shows. You can find this stuff. It was in national news left and right. I'm not going to go down that road anymore. We had Neil on, if you're curious, on the show on January 11th of this year. And he came on to talk about their efforts to acquire Tales of the Cocktail, what their vision was for Tales of the Cocktail, how they were going to address some of the problems of the past of Tales of the Cocktail. And I appreciate Neil coming on. I said this at the time, and I'm going to say it again. You know, the transaction hadn't closed. Neil had signed a non-disclosure agreement, so we had to be careful about certain things that were, of course, discussed on the show. But he came on, and he felt that it was important to get the word out on the street, get the word out to the industry, get the word out to cocktail enthusiasts that, you know, they were working to acquire Tales of the Cocktail, working to keep it here in New Orleans. And happy to report that the transaction has now closed. So Neil and the Solomon family, which is Gary Solomon Jr. and other members of the Solomon family, they operate the Solomon Group, which is a production company, does multimedia stuff. They did a lot of the scenic work there at the World War II Museum, all kinds of things like that. They have acquired the event. It will be staying here in New Orleans. They're turning it into, I should say, a true nonprofit. And what I mean by that is before, the way it was operated was a nonprofit, but there was a for-profit side that had a very cozy relationship that raised some eyebrows. Again, we talked about that extensively. They're going to go about things very differently and turn this into ideally a true educational nonprofit. So I'm looking forward to what the future holds for Tales of the Cocktail. It was under threat. It was under threat for its very existence. It was under threat. I think people were looking to acquire it, maybe in a sort of a profit-minded way, maybe move it out of New Orleans. It's going to be staying here. And that's a really overall a good thing for the city. It's a good thing for the industry. It's a good thing for our folks here. So I'm pleased to report that to you. We'll have more on that. I'm sure Neil will be on with us in the near future as the dust settles from all this. They've got a lot of work to do. Sleeves rolled up, I am sure, getting things going. They got Tales on Tour, as they call it, happening in Edinburgh here pretty quick, I think, in a couple months, Edinburgh, Scotland. So a lot going on there. As when Neil has a few moments, I'm sure we will get him on to talk about it. But there you go. Good news for Tales of the Cocktail. Good news for the city of New Orleans. Friends, French Quarter Festival is coming up. Yep, that is my favorite music festival on the planet. Make no mistake about it. Really excited. That is going to be taking place April 12th through the 15th. Of course, as the name denotes, it takes place in the French Quarter. Something like 22, 25 stages in that range, ranging from the big all on the lawn, the river there at Waldenburg Park, to the small stages there on Royal Street, for example. And you get the whole gamut of regional music. And that's why I love this festival so much, for many reasons. You can wander throughout the French Quarter. It's free. I believe it still is America's largest free music festival. But the emphasis is on regional music, obviously, New Orleans, Southeast Louisiana. So, you know, it's Cajun Zydeco stuff. It's R&B stuff. It's bounce stuff. It's jazz. It's blues. It's everything. And the list is great. The bands are great. You can go check out fqfi.org to see the lineup. They don't really have the time slots, I don't believe, out yet, but the bands that will be participating are listed. And it's just a great festival. And one of the things that's really cool about it, too, is the food and drink. A lot of the local restaurants are out there serving up food and drink. You have food booths all over the place, especially there at Waldenburg Park, Jackson Square, where they have a stage set up. And you can wander around, and there's just the eats are great. The drink's pretty good. So it's a lot of fun. And also, you know, it's in the French Quarter. So if you want to duck out for a little while and go to one of your favorite watering holes or one of your favorite restaurants, you can do that too. So check that out. Again, fqfi.org. It's going to be April 12th through the 15th. It's gone from a one-day festival back. This is their 35th anniversary, by the way. Started out as a one-day festival in Jackson Square. It's now four full days going from that Thursday, April 12th through Sunday. Just a lot of fun. And related to that, next week's show, we're going to be talking to the folks from French Quarter Festival. I'm really excited about that. We're going to be interviewing them, talking obviously about the festival in general, talking about the music, of course, and we're going to talk about the food and drink. So that'll be a lot of fun, something to stay tuned for and pay attention to. Also, next week on the show, we're going to be, we finally done it. It's happened, friends. The Two Dummies Food Tour. If you've been listening to this show for a while, it's been in the works for quite some time. My good pal Adrian Miller and I explore a little bit about eating, a little bit, you know, mostly emphasis on food, but a little bit about drink. And we're kicking off the Two Dummies Food Tour at St. Rock Market. They're, of course, on St. Claude. And we get with two or three different food vendors. Adrian works at the bar there at the Mayhaw, it's called. We have a couple drinks and then we eat some good food and we talk about it. Oh yeah, there it is. It was delicious. We actually taped it the other day, and that's going to be on the show next week. So do check that out, friends. One real quick note, be sure to check out our friends at toptaconola.com. Great event coming up March 15th. There's an industry event on March 14th. There's going to be a panel discussion that I've had the privilege of being asked to moderate during that event. That's on Wednesday during the day, March 14th at Audubon Aquarium. I will have some tickets in my back pocket if you are interested in going. There's a tequila judging. There's a panel on agave, all kinds of cool stuff happening at that event. If you're interested in going, hit us up on Facebook, Nola Drinks, send us a direct message, and let me know why you want to go. If you're a tequila fan or you're in the industry and you're a big tequila person, hey, I might have a couple tickets for you. We'll talk more about that, too, in the next couple weeks as well. Friends, hey, that's it for the show. Thanks for listening here today. I really appreciate it. Two Dummies Food Tour next week, French Quarter Festival next week. Lots of fun. Remember, as always, be kind to one another, use your turn signal. And until then, cheers, y'all.